Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Merry Christmas. Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, and today we have a Charlie Brown Christmas special for you. Not the one that you've been accustomed to seeing on TV over the years, but we'll visit with a World War II veteran by the name of Charlie Brown. Also in studio with us today, Bill Dietzel, whose Veterans Magazine is a must-read. If you've never seen it, I'll tell you where you can pick one up, tell you where you can find it online, and he has a special Christmas poem from his magazine to read for us a little bit later on. And another thing that I'd like to do this week, be thinking about this as the hour progresses. If you're a veteran and you have a Christmas story to share, a Christmas experience, a memory from a Christmas that you spent in the service, particularly overseas, in the service of our country, we would like to hear that story and why it sticks with you to this day. But primarily, through the course of this program, each and every week, we visit with veterans who served our country during World War II, and Charlie Brown is one of those. He'll turn 92 next month. You wouldn't know it by talking to him. He's still as sharp as he was when he was flying B-24s all over the Pacific. But before you ever flew B-24s, you spent a whole lot of hours in the sky before the war even started. When did you first get in the cockpit and take to the sky?
I got my private flying license in 1938. Got my private license. I was fully licensed by the time I went into the service.
And this was in far northern California. What was the name of the town?
Susanville.
Susanville area. And when Pearl Harbor happened, you were the superintendent of a lumber mill up there.
Yeah.
And you decided you wanted to stop chopping wood and try to chop up something else, huh?
That's about how it happened, yes.
Tell us the story, what you remember and why you decided to join the service.
Well, I was in the air, believe it or not, when the Japanese hit Pearl Harbor. And I did have a radio, and I heard about it, and I got so blasted sore and just upheaval in my mind as far as that goes, and I decided, here I am, an experienced pilot. I can do something. I can help. So I promptly enlisted.
How long did it take before you were actually flying a government-issued aircraft with the weapons behind you?
About 6 months.
6 months.
Yeah.
And I know we talked about it this before when we did our TV story, and you can still find Mr. Brown's video online at cbs47.tv if you want to watch the TV version of his story. We're going to get to some things we didn't touch on in that, because a lot of times when I'll visit with a veteran, we'll talk about all the experiences during the war, and just as I'm saying goodbye and thanking him for serving our country and thanking him for talking about it, he'll tell me one more story that I say, man, I wish we got that on TV. So in this case, I'm glad we have you on the radio program, because we're going to get to that one a little bit later. But as we continue with your service early on, a lot of guys, when they've already been in the air, when they've been a pilot and they just love to fly, you would think they'd gravitate towards fighters because of the maneuverability and all the tricks you can do. But you ended up in bombers. Was there a time when you wanted to be more of a fighter guy?
No, I thought this over very carefully, and I figured if I got into bombers, I would fly a wider range of airplanes. I'd get more experience, and that's the reason I went for multi-engine.
And you did end up flying a pretty wide range of aircraft.
Yes, I did. I sure did. I flew just about all of them.
Did you have a favorite?
Well, my old B-24 I loved dearly, and I also loved the P-38.
What about each one was near and dear to your heart?
Repeat, please.
What about those aircraft made them special to you? What did you like about the P-38 so much?
Oh, I loved the P-38 because it was so blasted fast.
Especially compared to a B-24.
Oh, yeah, and you know, you could do so much with it, and the way of aerobatics, and that's what I loved. While I was training with a B-24, occasionally I would get a chance to fly fighters.
And I know during the course of that, you came across a guy that you had grown up idolizing, that every young aspiring pilot in America had grown up idolizing. Tell us who that was and how you met him.
Well, that's still a bit embarrassing, but however, I'll tell it. We were at Albuquerque.
Mm-hmm.
And I was walking down the ramp, and in comes a B-17. And he bounced. You know, he generally, B-17s, they just flick it in. But it bounced.
That's a big no-no.
So I told my partner, I said, let's go give that pilot a bad time. So we did. We walked over there to where he's pulling up, pulled up and parked, went over there. And he gets out of the airplane, and it was Lindbergh.
His first time in a B-17, probably the reason
he bounced. It was his first time. He had never been checked out in one. He was just told to fly it that in that direction for some reason. I didn't find out why. But
so did you give him a hard time?
I should say not. I wanted to take off my hat and bow to him.
Now, it's a little-known fact that a lot of people know that he was against the military effort early on and that he, in fact, had done some consulting in other parts of the country. But later on in the war in the Pacific, he actually got in the air in a P-38.
Oh, yes, he did. Yeah, he flew fighter cover, and he had flown at least twice fighter cover for me. So I know he was in the air. He was supposed to have flown an unarmed airplane, but he was an ace just the same, which meant that he shot down at least five.
So you know the truth that he...
Yes, that's the truth.
Because you were there and you saw him. What was that like when you actually got to be around this guy and fly next to this guy who was the pioneer for American aviation?
Well, it was just like hanging around with God. You know, it's...
You're in good company.
God had been my flying hero all my life, you know.
Did you ever have a chance to tell him that, or were you too timid?
I wouldn't tell him that, no. I did talk to him, but... No, I wouldn't tell him that. I was too awe-stricken.
Why do you think it is that not more people know about what he actually did over there? Do you think he wanted it to be kept secret?
Yes, I do. I know for sure he wanted it kept secret. Number one, he was told not to do any flying in combat area.
Mm-hmm.
That. And then he was told by the officers over there, you can't fly an armed airplane, which was crazy, foolishness.
Why take the best pilot out of something that could help your effort? And one thing that he did admit to, Mr. Lindbergh, Charles Lindbergh, of course, is who we're talking about, the Lone Eagle, he did admit to helping not just P-38s, but bombers, too, and a lot of different aircraft improve their fuel efficiency, sometimes exponentially.
He, the one that I know about, he just about doubled the range of the P-38.
What kind of a difference did something like that make? What would that enable pilots like you to do that you wouldn't have been able to do before?
Well, it didn't affect me so much as it did the pilots that flew them, because they flew fighter cars or other planes, and to double the range of that thing made mighty fine.
A significant contribution.
You bet it was.
Whether he owned up to all his kills or not.
Yes.
Now, let's talk about some of your experiences. We have to hit a commercial here in just a minute, but before we get to that, maybe you can share with our listeners. And I know with being in the air with over 11,000 hours, some of those experiences kind of blend together, but I'm sure you remember the first mission that you had to fly. Tell us a little bit about that.
I have to think just a moment. But... I think one of the funniest things about that first mission is that I had my crew aboard, and we were on our way home, and we were flying across the Celebes Islands, and we'd been flying for quite some time, and the tail gunner called me on our radio, and he said, you know, there's red ribbons coming up here. I said, my God, that's fire. And I put it in a vertical to turn away from that and get away from that fire. But, yeah, they were shooting at us, that's for sure. But, you know, being completely green to combat, he had no idea that he was being fired on.
Red ribbons.
Yeah.
Flak was red ribbons.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And obviously that was a welcome to the war moment. This is for real now. We aren't training anymore. You're not shooting at a sleeve of canvas. This is the real thing.
Yeah, somebody was after us for sure.
Well, we're going to talk more about those experiences when guys were after us, when he had to do things he never thought he might have to do in the line of duty. This is Charlie Brown, B-24, World War II bomber pilot on Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I'm your host, Paul Leffler, joined today by B-24 pilot Charlie Brown. Bill Dietzel will join us later, talk about Veterans Magazine, read a special Christmas poem that appears in that magazine. And if we have a little time, we'll take some phone calls at 490-5858 or toll-free 800-776-5858. Maybe in your time in the service, you have a Christmas memory that you would like to share with us briefly this afternoon. We'll try to make some time for that. Right now, we continue with a pilot who flew 56 combat missions during World War II, part of the Jolly Rogers, the famous Jolly Rogers in their black flag. We'll have a story about that black flag a little bit later on. Mr. Brown was part of the 319th Bomb Squadron, and he earned a Distinguished Flying Cross. Every time you find out that the guy has a DFC, you have to find out the story behind that DFC. And I believe that yours started on the way back from a bombing raid at Formosa. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Tell us what you remember about that. First, tell us what the mission was and what you remember doing starting off with that mission.
Can you remind me a little bit of...
When you went to Formosa and you dropped your bombs and you were coming back and you ended up with a situation that you hadn't had to deal with before, is trying to land the plane and keep everybody in your crew alive and intact.
Oh, that one. That one, yes. Yeah, we landed...
You got shot up a little bit, I believe.
Yeah, we did. We got shot up. We had two engines out on it. And it won't fly very long on two engines.
We're talking about a B-24 here.
And I had to land, and we were flying right over the Philippines at that time. We had a chance to either land on what we knew was enemy held or ditch. But we knew the ditching characteristics of the B-24. You were lucky if 50% of the crew lived.
Mm-hmm.
From a ditching, so we decided to go in. So we landed on this airstrip, Mangaldan Airstrip in Lingayen Gulf, on Manila.
And I believe you didn't know who controlled that airstrip, did you?
No. When we left for the mission that morning in our briefing, it was still Jap-held. But they figured the infantry was in there, and they figured by nightfall that our troops would probably be on it. So we decided under the circumstances, we decided that if we did land there, the Japs couldn't get us out of there. So that would be no problem. So we decided to go ahead and land on that Mangaldan airstrip.
And what did you find when you hit the ground?
Well, I flew between three different Japanese airplanes.
Which is not necessarily encouraging.
No, that's not a bit encouraging under the circumstances. But anyway, when we landed, I pulled over and I just turned the engines off and waited, and there was a knock on the bomb bay door, and I opened it. And an American major stuck his head in. He said, "You're calling it kind of close, aren't you, Lieutenant?" I said, "Well, yes, I am. What are you doing here?" He said, "We took it 2 hours ago."
So you were that close.
Well, I was that close.
2 hours earlier, you would have landed on a Japanese-controlled airstrip.
They couldn't have done anything with us. We weren't afraid of that. But
there were some other moments in the war where somebody was smiling on you and allowed you to stay alive and keep the rest of your crew alive. And I think a surgeon somewhere in the Midwest, the name of Tom Reed, has a special reason to be glad that you were in the cockpit of that B-24. Am I right about that?
Yes, sir.
Your B-24 was shot up and a crank wouldn't work anymore?
Yeah, he was... Tom Reed was stuck in the turret.
He was a ball turret gunner.
Yeah, he was a ball turret gunner. And the gear mechanism for the turret was shot up. And I couldn't retract the turret. So he had to just stay in there until we landed.
But if you're trying to land a B-24 and you can't get that turret back up, it's a little dangerous for the guy who's sitting in that turret.
Yeah, if you bounced an inch or two, you're going to mash him.
When did you realize that you were actually going to have to put that plane down with him still in there?
Well, I knew about it immediately upon it happening.
Mm-hmm.
That I had a passenger in there that I didn't care about landing on.
And there's no way to get him out of there until you land.
Oh, we tried everything. But it took welding equipment. The gear mechanism to bring that turret up had to use welding on it to cutting torch.
Mm-hmm. Which I guess we give away the ending on that, but I probably already did. But here you are flying along, and you realize I probably need the perfect landing to keep him from being ground to bits on the runway.
Yes, and the way the B-24 is built, when it's sitting empty on the field, that turret, if it's down, is within an inch or so of ground.
Mm-hmm.
If you landed, we had 10 inches of clearance in our shock absorbers. So I could actually go down 8 or 10 inches. And if I did, it would have chewed him up.
So what in your mind, as you're coming toward the runway and trying to land, what were you trying to do? What was your hope? What did you figure that you had to do in order to keep him alive?
I had to land without bouncing.
And that's easy in a B-24, right?
No, it isn't.
Just ask Lindbergh in his B-17. You knew this was going to be extremely difficult, didn't you?
Of course I did, but I really had no choice. So I did.
How did you do that? What were you saying a prayer as you came down? Were you closing your eyes?
What I said, I've had to figure out how to land with the least chance of bouncing. So what I did, I brought it in. Instead of a gradual stall for landing, I brought it in and touched my wheels down at cruising speed so that I could land absolutely without bouncing. And then I gradually cut my throttles. And it did settle down. By the time it settled down, we were stopped. So,
when did you realize that you had been successful in keeping him alive?
Immediately. The whole crew was telling me about it.
A lot of cheers, a lot of pats on the back?
Yes.
When you think about that today, is that what you're most proud of in your service to our country, the fact that your friend Tom Reed survived that?
Well, I feel pretty good about it, I'll tell you for sure. He was a wonderful man. In fact, he's a retired surgeon now.
So a lot of people that had his steady hand at their operation that he wouldn't have been there for it if
That's
it hadn't
for
been
sure.
for you,
That's
bringing that B-24 in. Well, I know that he's thankful for that. I want to thank you, too, for your service to our country. And I want, before we run out of time, we still have plenty for now, you were with the Jolly Rogers. Explain to our listeners a little bit about how that group got that name and why you guys were the Jolly Rogers.
You know, the real details of that have slipped my mind. I don't remember, but it was a newly formed group, and somebody had mentioned to a full colonel that was in charge of it that it's a shame to turn it over to a bunch of pirates. And somebody said, Jolly Rogers.
And the flag was the symbol of your group. So people knew that you were the Jolly Rogers, and you proudly displayed a big black pirate flag.
Yeah, on the tail, on the huge rudders on there. For instance, my plane had a blue background on it. It was a blue background, and then painted in white was a skull and cross bombs beneath it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was our trademark.
And I understand that also where you were stationed, you had, besides being on the actual aircraft, you had an actual flag that was up, marking that was your domain, right?
Oh, that still makes me mad.
Well, tell me the story.
Let's hear it.
Now, I guess the backdrop on this is the guys in the Army Air Corps had a little bit of a rivalry going with some of the Navy guys, particularly the Navy pilots. Is that right?
Well, you know, there's always... We always figured that our major enemy was the enemy, and but we had a real good fun thing going on there between us. But what had happened, we had been to Sydney on leave, and we had bought a new flag, a huge black flag that had the skull and crossbones on it. And we had that flying over our headquarters, and one of these Navy flyers came in with an SVD and slowed it down just as low as he could, and he dropped that.
He dropped paper bags filled with paint?
A paper bag.
One paper bag filled with paint.
Filled with white paint. And he hit that flag.
Nailed it.
Dead center. But then the war was really on.
So naturally, you had to do something. If in the time that you had, when you weren't busy dropping bombs on the Japanese or flying combat missions, you had to do something to get that Navy guy back. Tell us what you did.
Are you referring to the carrier?
Right.
Well, I couldn't. My wingspan was 110 feet.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't land on the carrier. But I flew out. There was a carrier in the bay out there, and I flew out. And I dropped my flaps, and I dropped my landing gear, and I approached the carrier as though I was going to land. And I got up fairly close, and they were waving their flags, and just all kinds of action going on. They were turning the carrier. And so when I got right to the deck, well, then I peeled off.
And that was the end of it, right? You never heard another word.
No, that started the Second War.
Doesn't work that way in the military. You can't just get away with something.
No.
So I imagine the second you landed, you realized someone had seen that. Someone was paying attention. You got summoned?
Oh, yes. My goodness, I had forgotten about that. The court-martial.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-oh. I didn't know that we had court-martialed guests on this program. We better finish this story when we come back from a commercial break. I need to regroup here. You'll hear the entertaining end to that story about his little rivalry with the Navy guys and the court-martial proceedings that ensued and how that court-martial proceeding ended up at the end of all of those shenanigans between the servicemen. We're going to take a short break here, come back with more Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. In a few minutes, we'll take some of your phone calls at 490-5858, toll-free 800-776-5858. Want to hear if you have a Christmas memory from your time in the service. For now, we continue with Charlie Brown, a decorated B-24 pilot who, after getting into a little bit of a rivalry with the Navy pilots who had dropped paint on their Jolly Roger black flag, he buzzed the aircraft carrier, pretended like he was going to land his behemoth B-24 on their deck, and then flew away. But when he hit the ground, he was summoned, and he was told that he had to go to court-martial proceedings, and this was pretty scary for a guy in your position, I have to imagine. Were you a little nervous?
Yes, I was. I was very nervous. I figured I'd really pulled it this time.
What did you find when you walk in that door, you look out, and there's some superior officers sitting at a table, I imagine? Tell us what that was like.
They called me in. As soon as I landed, they called me into headquarters. And I went up to headquarters, and there were several senior officers there. And they started telling me what kind of trouble I was in, and I would probably have to go through a court-martial, which I did. Did you want to hear about that?
Absolutely. Tell us everything.
Well, we got into the court-martial, and the officer presenting the case, boy, he went over that in great detail about what I'd done and how I had put men in danger of their lives and one way or another. And as a matter of fact, he embellished slightly here and there on it. But
You're over there thinking, man, I'm getting railroaded here. This is a bum deal. What's going on?
Yes, I did. But it proceeded on. So anyway, I was able to present my case. They went on, and I was found guilty. You know, well, what am I going to get out of this? I figured I was probably through as a pilot.
Which for you would be a big deal. You were flying before the war. This is what you loved, being in the air.
Yes, right.
So your whole life as a pilot is flashing in front of your eyes here.
So, anyway, they decided that the time to sentence me was right then. So I had to stand up and attention while they had to sentence, and they read the sentence and told what I had done and how I had endangered everybody. And they said, well, because you are guilty, you're going to be sentenced right now. And we have found that you are a very bad boy. And that was the end of the court martial.
And you breathed a giant sigh of relief. They didn't even make you vow never to buzz an aircraft carrier with a B-24 again.
Nobody did that. I'm afraid I wouldn't sign that.
Well, Charlie, we very much appreciate you being here today, and thank you so much for your service to our country and everything that you've contributed to our society for helping to make it the country that it is today. Is there anything else that you would like to share with our listeners, any other memories from the war that really stand out in your mind that you think it's important people know about?
No, I don't think so. I think that pretty well covers the key points. I could talk forever, but then, you know, that's part of my trade is talking.
Talking and flying. And you were a flight instructor for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
So you got to mold both of those together. Well, again, thank you for being here. Stick around. Maybe some of our callers would like to have something to say to you. And now as we bring in Bill Dietzel, I want to read for you quickly. And if you're not familiar with Bill, if you're involved at all in any kind of military organization here in the Valley, you probably do know who Bill Dietzel is. If you don't, one of his hats is the publisher and editor of Veterans Magazine, which is produced here in the Valley but can be picked up all over the place. Troops overseas get it. It's distributed through the VA hospital system. And the place I usually pick mine up is at the Veterans Memorial Museum downtown. I guess I need to fill out a subscription form so you're getting some money from me instead of picking it up for free downtown at the Veterans Memorial Museum. But I want to read for you real quick just the little capsule that's next to Bill's picture inside of the magazine, because I think this hits the nail on the head. This is the spirit behind his magazine. He says, "It is now our duty as the beneficiaries of freedom never to forget those men and women who courageously fought and died for it. We will continue to tell the story, for without the sacrifice of the American serviceman and woman, we would not have the United States of America." Amen. Bill, thank you for what you're doing, and thanks for being here today. And tell our listeners briefly about your service and the time that you spent in the military long before you thought you might be a magazine publisher.
Well, Merry Christmas to all you veterans out there. And like Paul said, if you get a chance, call in and tell us your story. My story started back in 1952 when I was standing in line at the induction center. I was drafted. Like many others were drafted in those days. And I'm standing in line, and here comes a Marine, here comes a Navy guy, and here comes an Air Force guy walking by saying, you, come over here. And the next thing you know, the Marine walked right on by me, thank goodness. And the next thing I knew, the Air Force guy says, "You're too tall to be a Marine, come with me." So with that, I was officially put into the United States Air Force. That was 1952. 1952, I went to boot camp down in Lackland, went through all the, I went through flight engineer school, and ended up at K-14 in Kinsan, Korea. Spent my time over there, turned around, and came back home, got stationed at Victorville, California. From there, I went to England to a B-29 outfit. Flew a panel over there for many years, and panel means that you're a flight engineer on airplane. In a theory, a flight engineer is the person that actually owns airplanes. We only let you old pilots fly them, but you have to give them back at the end of the day in perfect condition. So with that, I went to Strategic Air Command and went TDY up here to Castle Air Force Base, and flew I don't remember exactly how many, 40 or 50 trips over to Vietnam, hauling supplies, troops, whatever it was that we could pack onto the airplane and fly them over. And that's what I did for the 20 years. And it was a great life. I ended up retiring as a Chief Master Sergeant. And really proud to be part of the military and be proud to be a veteran of the United States.
Well, that's evident to anyone who meets you. I want to ask you, when you got this idea, and people that don't know, I should mention that Bill also spends a lot of his time organizing the Veterans Day Parade in Fresno, which has grown to be the biggest west of the Mississippi as far as the number of participants. It's a tradition that's been going for 88 years now, and he is carrying that flag for all the veterans in the valley. When did you get this idea to publish this magazine? I'm sure it's not something that you just do on a whim. You have to be serious about it, and obviously...
Oh, you have to be very serious. I give all the credit to a gentleman that's now passed. His name was Paul Barkas. And many people here in town knew Paul Barkas because he was a veterans advocate, strong, strong person to support the veterans over his tenure in life. And we were sitting down, and we used to call each... We had what we call a gang of six. And we would go up here to Big Boys up on Blackstone and sit in there and we hash over what's coming up and what we're doing for the veterans, so on and so forth. And I've been producing a newsletter that went out to the 420th Air Refueling Squadron, one of the outfits I was with over in England. And he turned around after seeing several of them and he said, why don't you start a veterans magazine here in the valley? And I looked at Paul and I said, do you have any idea what it takes to do a veterans magazine? He says, no, but you can do it. So with that, in theory, I went home and I got on my computer and I said, well, what if I did this and what if I did that? So I designed up the magazine at that point. And then also reality sets in and says, well, how are you going to pay for the printing? Because printing a full glossy magazine is not exactly inexpensive. So with that, I went out and I sold enough money, ads, to print the first issue. I kept all the checks in because I had a lot of doubt all the time that you're going through there. And I kept the checks up to the time that I handed all the checks, went to the bank, opened up an account, and I wrote the first check to the printer and went, wow. And then from that point on, that was 5 years ago. And since then, we have been successful, very successful. This year, because this year is over with. it's almost last year. We were voted the number one veterans magazine in the state of California by the veterans, and we're very, very proud of that. And we're very proud of all the veterans that send us stories. And while I'm on that subject, you veterans out there or even active military that have stories, get online and go to veteransmagazine.com. It's real simple, veteransmagazine.com. All of our information's in there. Send us photos, send us this or send it that, but take a look at us because... We are supporting you, the veterans out here, and we're very, very proud to be able to back up all the veterans and all the military people.
And you have seen a lot of growth since you took that leap of faith initially and just got it printed. Now you're seeing it head out to a lot of different places. I want you to tell us how far the reach has grown for that, and also what your vision is long-term. I know it's published here in the Valley. A lot of the stories involve Valley guys. I enjoyed reading there's a great article in the latest issue about men of the 442nd who were given medals of honor, and two of those guys who are now deceased were both from Fresno, buried here in Fresno. There's always a local angle in there, but I have a feeling that your vision for this magazine is to not just reach the Valley, but go far beyond that, and I think you're already doing that.
We are. We started out, I printed 10,000 the first time, and because that's all I could afford. And then from that point on, we are now up to 50,000. We got a readership pretty close to 400,000. We were in 800 Walmart stores across the nation, which is very, very strong. The distributor decided to change locations, and he shut down the distribution. That's Anderson News, which is the largest in the United States as far as distributing magazines and books. And they shut down until they got their new place open up here in Stockton. In February, we'll be back on the market locally throughout the state of California in Walmart stores, Barnes & Nobles, wherever it may be. And reaching out and going into the future is very important when you start looking at We have representation that's now in Connecticut in this particular story, in this particular issue, November. There's a story in there called These Scars Are Sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And from that point on, Elliot Storm, who wrote it, contacted me and he says, do you realize how successful your magazine is here in Connecticut? I sent him about 10 boxes, and everybody wanted it. And then it's starting to spread out. We're developing a lot of relationships with a company online called Vets Friends, which has 835,000 registered veterans with them. And with that, they've taken it upon us. We're doing a promotional, cross-promotional with them, which we're very proud of. So all of this is coming up in the future. Keeping in mind that I always feel like we got the greatest graphics group in the world. If you look at this magazine, which is a high-gloss magazine, and it's all contributed to one person. His name is Tom Rittimer with Rittimer Concepts. Tom lives down in Visalia out in the foothills. We're probably 80 miles apart. But yet we put out this magazine. I do all the story content, get the photos together, design the magazine, and I ship it down to him. He puts it together. Next thing you know, it goes to the printer. And we're very proud of that part.
Well, it looks great, and I know the website, too, has won awards already, and that's veteransmagazine.com. Is that the best way if someone's listening and they want to subscribe to this magazine? Should they go to the website? Should they call a phone number? What's the best thing for them?
If you go online to veteransmagazine.com and go to the subscription column that's in there, there's a PayPal hook to it, and all you have to do is just fill it out. PayPal will take all your credit cards. Subscribe is $25 a year, and it's $40 the second year, $60 for 3 years. And it's a magazine that you will be proud to have in your home. It's not a throwaway. There's so many magazines out here today. You run through it real quick, and all of a sudden, there's nothing in here. It doesn't have any substance. The one thing about Veterans Magazine, it's a history book. Mm-hmm. And so many people keep these books because if you think about it, the children today, and I'm talking about 17, 18-year-olds, even the 20-year-olds today have no concept of what Pearl Harbor was, what Charlie Brown went through, what I went through during my tenure in the service. And the thing about it is when you lay this magazine down in front of them and they look at it and they go, Dad, what'd you do in the war? And that's kind of key because veterans today, as well as the old-timers, have the tendency of just clamming up, not telling anybody. And I think they're missing it because if your family doesn't know what you did in the service, they will never know. And they're always in doubt, what did Dad do or what did Grandpa do in the service?
And if you want your kids to love their country the way you love your country, then there's nothing better you can do than to share that. And that's what this program's all about. That's why we're here. We need to get in one final commercial break. If you have a Christmas story from your time in the service that you want to share with us quickly, you can call us at 490-5858, 800-776-5858. We'll be right back with more Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
As you celebrate this holiday season, say a special Christmas prayer for our troops serving overseas. Go to KMJ580.com for greetings from some of those hometown heroes. Sunday afternoon, we'll visit with another hero from the greatest generation. This Valley veteran flew P-38s with Charles Lindbergh, but spent most of his time in the cockpit of a B-24. Hear all his close calls, including the one that earned him a Distinguished Flying Cross. I'm Paul Leffler. I hope you'll join me Sunday at 4 for Hometown Heroes, only on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
You've heard about some of those exploits in the air for B-24 pilot Charlie Brown, who flew 56 missions and has a Distinguished Flying Cross to show for it. We've been visiting with Bill Dietzel, another veteran who publishes Veterans Magazine. It's headquartered here in the Valley, but has a reach that is ever expanding. And of all the people that are reading that magazine, it comes out once every 2 months, I should say, six issues a year. And the latest magazine, which you can recognize, the front of it talks about D-Day, the 5th Rangers at Omaha, which is a great article inside the magazine, and it has the artwork from the Medals of Honor Heroes 2 video game. But also inside the magazine, what you'll find is a special Christmas poem, and I thought it would be appropriate, as we're on Christmas Eve, if Bill Dietzel read to you that poem, which appears in his magazine.
Thank you, and I want to send this out to all the veterans and all the military across this world that's listening to us tonight. It's called The Soldier's Night Before Christmas. 'Twas the night before Christmas. He lived all alone in a one-bedroom house made of plaster and stone. I had come down the chimney with presents to give and to see just who in this home did live. I looked all about, a strange sight I did see. No tinsel, no presents, not even a tree. No stockings by mantle, just boots filled with sand. On the wall hung pictures of a far distant land. With medals and badges, awards of all kinds, a sober thought came through my mind. For this house was different. It was dark and dreary. I found the home of a soldier, once I could see very clearly. The soldier lay sleeping, silent and alone, curled up on the floor in this one-bedroom home. The face was so gentle, the home was in such disorder. Not how I pictured a United States soldier. Was this the hero whom I just read, curled up on a poncho, the floor for a bed? I realized the families that I saw that this night owed their lives to these soldiers who were willing to fight. Soon around the world the children would play and grown-ups would celebrate a bright Christmas day. Then all enjoyed freedom each month of the year because of the soldiers like this one laying here. I couldn't help wonder how many lay alone on a cold Christmas Eve in a land far from home. The very thought brought a tear to my eye. I dropped to my knees and I started to cry. The soldier awakened and I heard a rough voice. I fight for freedom. This life is my choice. I don't ask for more. My life is my God, my country, my core. The soldier rolled over and drifted to sleep. I couldn't control it. I continued to weep. I kept watch for hours, so silent and still, and we both shivered from the cold night's chill. I didn't want to leave on this cold, dark night, this guardian of honor so willing to fight. Then the soldier rolled over with a voice soft and pure, whispered, "Carry on, Santa, it's Christmas Day. All is secure." One look at my watch and I knew he was right. Merry Christmas, my friends, and to all a good night. From the staff of Veterans Magazine, Bill and Marilyn Dietzel and family, Tom and Amy Rittimer and Michelle Ennis, to the soldiers standing in the line to make our freedom possible, to our veterans, their families, and readers and supporters, Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night.
Well done. I think our listeners appreciated that very much. Is that something that you wrote personally?
No, but I have a very good friend of mine that wrote it, and he says, just wanted to say anonymous. He was a captain in Vietnam when he wrote it. Think about that.
That adds a little context to it. And that's one thing that has really touched me, too, through all the veterans that I've interviewed, is a lot of them did express themselves through writing things down, through writing poems. I have a Marine cinematographer friend who wrote a beautiful poem about the Marine Corps and the gentleman that served with him. And it's amazing, as intense as war can be, the pauses between that intensity, I think, give a lot of guys pause to come up with some of the most brilliant things that we've seen written, and certainly the most poignant. And that, I think, was a great addition to the program today.
You know, let me say something. Last night, I was with World the Pearl Watson.
Another guy who's been on the cover of your magazine.
And he invited Marilyn and I and over to his home for dinner. And we were sitting there at the table enjoying ourselves. I looked at him, I says, "Earl, where were you 63 years ago tonight?" And he says, "I was laying in a trench in the Battle of the Bulge."
That's right.
That's emotional.
And there are countless others in this valley who are in that same position.
Very much so.
Freezing their rear ends off for our freedom. We have a caller on the line here. We only got about 30 seconds in the show, so Bronco Bob, you're going to have to make it snappy.
I just wanted to say thank you for the poem. Thank you for your service. Wish a happy Merry Christmas to all of our military personnel all over the world. Keep them safe and come home soon. Have a great Christmas. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob, and thank you for serving our country. We're out of time for this edition of Hometown Heroes. Thanks to Charlie Brown and Bill Dietzel for being here. Check out veteransmagazine.com and get your hands on a copy of that fine publication. And I hope that you and your family have a very Merry Christmas. Remember the men and women serving our country overseas. Good night.